He ducked through the passing crowds towards a narrow side street. "This way is the quickest." Logan caught him by the arm.
"Down there?"
He peered into the gloom.
"You sure?"
"Can you doubt it?" demanded Longfoot, suddenly horrified.
"Can it be that you could doubt it? Among all my remarkable talents, it is my skill at navigation that is paramount. It is for that talent above all that the first of the Magi has made so generous a contribution to the coffers of the Order. Could it be that you—" But wait.
He held up his hand and began to smile again, then tapped Logan on the chest with his forefinger.
"You do not know Brother Longfoot. Not yet. You are watchful and cautious, I see it. Fine qualities in their place. I cannot expect you to have my unshakable faith in my abilities. No, that would not be fair. Unfairness is not an admirable quality. No, unfairness is not my way."
I shall convince you," shouted Longfoot.
"Indeed I shall. You will come to trust my word before your own. Yes, this way is the quickest."
And he strode off down the dingy alleyway with remarkable speed, Logan struggling to keep up, though his legs were a good half foot longer.
"Ah, the back streets,"
called the navigator over his shoulder as they passed down dark and grimy lanes, the buildings crowding in ever closer.
"The back streets, eh?"
The alleys grew narrower, darker, and dirtier still. The little man turned to the left and the right, never pausing for an instant to consider his course.
"Do you smell that? Do you smell that, Master Nine Fingers? It smells like—"
He rubbed his thumbs and fingertips together as he strode along, searching for the words.
"Mystery! Adventure!"
It smelled like shit to Logan. A man lay on his face in the gutter, dead drunk perhaps, or maybe simply dead. Other men passed by, limping and haggard, or standing in threatening groups in doorways, handing round bottles. There were women here, too.
"Four marks, and I'll give you a blessing, Northman,"
one of them called to Logan as they passed.
"A blessing you won't soon forget. Three, then."
"Horse,"
whispered Longfoot, shaking his head.
"And cheap ones, too. You like women?"
"Well,
you should go to Ulnab, my friend, Ulnab on the shores of the Southern Sea. You could buy a bed slave there, indeed you could. They cost a fortune, but they train these girls for years."
"You can buy a girl?" asked Logan, mystified.
"Boys, too, if your taste bends that way."
"Hey?"
"They train them for years, truly. It's a whole industry down there. You want skilled, do you? These girls have skills you wouldn't believe. Or visit Sapani. There are places in that city. Phew! The women are beautiful. Beautiful, everyone. Truly, like princesses." "And clean,"
he muttered, peering at one of the scruffy women by the roadside. A bit of dirt didn't bother Logan any. Skilled and beautiful all sounded too complicated to him. One girl caught his eye as they passed, leaning against a doorframe with one arm up. Watching them pass with a half-hearted smile, Logan found her pretty in a desperate sort of a way. Prettier than he was, anyway, and it had been a long time. You have to be realistic about these things. Logan stopped in the street.
"Baez wanted change," he muttered.
"He did. He was most specific on the subject."
"There's money to spare, then?" Longfoot raised one eyebrow.
"Well, perhaps. Let me see."
He pulled out the purse with a flourish and opened it, rooting around inside. There was a loud jingling of coins. "You think that's a good idea?" Logan glanced nervously up and down the street. Several faces had turned towards them.
"What's that?"
asked the navigator, still poking around in the purse. He pulled some coins out, holding them up to the light and peering at them, then pressed them into Logan's palm. "Subtlety isn't one of your talents, is it?" Some of the shabby men in the alley began to move slowly, curiously towards them, two from in front, one from behind.
"No, indeed," laughed Longfoot. "No, indeed. I am a straight-talking man, that is my way. Yes, indeed. I am a—"
He had noticed the shadowy figures sidling towards them now.
Ah, this is unfortunate. Oh, dear.
Logan turned to the girl.
Do you mind if we...
She slammed the door shut in his face. Other doors up and down the street began to close.
Shit, he said. How are you at fighting?
God has seen fit to bless me with many remarkable talents, murmured the navigator, but combat is not one of them.
One of the men had an ugly squint.
That's a big purse for a little man, he said as he came close.
Well,
murmured Longfoot, creeping behind Logan's shoulder.
An awful big load for a little man to carry, said the other. Why not let us help you with it?
Neither one of them had weapons ready, but by the way their hands were moving, Logan knew they had them. There was a third man behind him, too. He could sense him moving forwards now. Close. Closer than the other two. If he could deal with that one first, the one behind, his chances might be good. He couldn't risk looking round. That would spoil the surprise. He'd simply have to hope for the best. As always. Logan gritted his teeth and flung his elbow backwards. It hit the man behind in the jaw with a heavy crunch, and Logan caught his wrist in his other hand, which was lucky, because he had a knife out and ready. Logan smashed him in the mouth with his elbow again, tearing the blade from his limp fingers as he dropped into the street, head smacking against the dirty cobbles. He whipped round, half expecting to get stabbed in the back, but the other two hadn't moved too quick. They had knives of their own out, and one had taken a half step towards him, but he paused when he saw that Logan had the blade up, ready to fight. It was a meager kind of a weapon, 6 inches of rusty iron without even a crosspiece, but it was better than nothing, a lot better. Logan waved it around in the air in front of him, just to make sure that everyone could see it. Felt good. His odds were much improved.
"Right then," said Logan. "Who's next?"
The other two moved apart, trying to get to either side of him, weighing their knives in their hands, but they didn't seem in any great rush to come on.
"We can take him,"
whispered the squinter, but his friend didn't look too sure.
"Or you can have this."
Logan opened up his clenched fist, showing the coins that Longfoot had given him.
"And leave us be. This much I can spare."
He swished the knife around a bit more, just to add some weight to his words.
"This is what you're worth to me. This much, no more. What's it to be?"
The one with the squint spat on the ground.
"We can take him," he hissed again. "You go first."
"You fucking go," shouted the other. "Just take what I'm offering," said Logan. "Then we none of us have to go."
The one that he'd elbowed groaned and rolled over in the road, and the reminder of his fate seemed to decide them.
"All right, you fucking northern bastard. All right, we'll take it."
Logan grinned. He thought about throwing the coins at the one with the squint, then stabbing him while he was distracted. That's what he'd have done in his youth, but he decided against. Why bother? Instead, he opened his fingers and tossed the money into the road behind him, moving towards the nearest wall. He and the two thieves circled each other cautiously, each step taking them closer to the coins and him closer to escape. Soon they'd swapped places, and Logan backed away down the street, still holding the knife in front of him. When they were 10 paces apart, the two men squatted down and began to pick the scattered coins up from the ground.
"I'm still alive,"
Logan whispered to himself as he quickened his pace. That had been lucky, he knew. It's a fool who thinks that any fight is too small to be the death of him, however tough he is. Lucky that he caught the one behind just right. Lucky that the other two had been slow. But then, he'd always been lucky with fights. Lucky at getting out of them alive. Not so lucky with the getting into them. Still, he felt good about this day's work. Glad he hadn't killed anybody. Logan felt a hand clap him on the back, and he span round, knife at the ready.
"Only me!"
Brother Longfoot held up his hands. Logan had nearly forgotten the navigator was there. He must have stayed behind him the whole time, perfectly silent.
Well handled, Master Ninefingers, well handled, truly. I see that you are not without some talents of your own. I am looking forward to travelling with you, I am indeed. The docks are this way, he shouted, already moving off.
Logan took one last look back at the two men, but they were still grubbing around on the ground, so he threw the knife away and hurried to catch up to Longfoot.
Do you navigators never fight?
Some among us do, oh yes, with empty hands and weapons of all kinds. Most deadly, some of them, but not I. No, that is not my way.
Never?
Never. My skills lie elsewhere.
I would have thought your travels would bring you across many dangers.
They do, said Longfoot brightly. They do indeed. That is when my remarkable talent for hiding is at its most useful.
Chapter 33 Her Kind Fight Everything. Night. Cold. The salt wind was keen on the hilltop, and Pharaoh's clothes were thin and ragged. She hugged her arms and hunched up her shoulders, staring sourly down towards the sea. Dagoska was a cloud of pinprick lights in the distance, huddled around the steep rock between the great curving bay and the glistening ocean. Her eyes could make out the vague, tiny shapes of walls and towers, black against the dark sky, and the thin neck of dry earth that joined the city to the land. An island, almost. Between them and Dagoska, there were fires. Camps around the roads. Many camps.
Dagoska, whispered Yulwe, perched on a rock beside her. A little splinter of the Union, stuck into Gurkul like a thorn. A thorn in the Emperor's pride.
Ha! Grunted Pharaoh, hunching her shoulders still further. The city is watched. Many soldiers. More than ever. It might be difficult to deceive so many.
Perhaps we should go back, she muttered hopefully.
The old man ignored her.
They are here as well. More than one.
Eaters?
I must go closer. Find a way in. Wait here for me.
He paused, waiting for her to reply.
You will wait.
All right, she hissed. All right, I'll wait.
Yulwe slipped off his rock and away down the slope, padding across the soft earth, almost invisible in the inky blackness. When the sound of his jingling bangles had faded into the night, she turned away from the city, took a deep breath, and scurried down the slope southwards, back into Gurkul. Now Pharaoh could run, fast as the wind, hours at a stretch. She'd spent a lot of time running. When she made it to the base of the hill, she ran, feet flying across the open ground, breath coming quick and fierce. She heard water beyond, slid down a bank, and splashed into the shallows of a slow-moving river. She floundered on, knee-deep in the cold water.
Let the old bastard track me through this, she thought.
After a while, she made a bundle of her weapons and held them above her head as she swam across, forcing against the current with one arm. She flapped out on the other side and ran on along the bank, wiping the water from her dripping face. Time passed slowly, and light began to creep into the sky. Morning was coming. The river babbled beside her, her sandals beating out a rapid rhythm in the stubbly grass. She left the river behind, running on across the flat landscape, turning now from black to grey. A clump of scrubby trees loomed up. She crashed between the trunks and slithered down into the bushes, her breath rasping. She shivered in the half-light, heart pounding in her chest. It was silent beyond the trees. Good. She reached inside her clothes and pulled out some bread and a strip of meat, soggy from the swim, but still edible. She smiled. She had been keeping half of everything that Yulwe gave her for the last few days.
Stupid old bastard,
she chuckled to herself between choking mouthfuls.
Thought he could get the better of Pharaoh Mal'jin, did he?
Damn, she was thirsty. No help for that now, she could find water later. She was tired, though, very tired. Even Pharaoh got tired. She would rest here for a moment, just a moment, get the strength back in the legs. Then on to... She twitched, annoyed. She could think about the where later. Wherever was best for vengeance. Yes. She crawled through the bushes, sat back against one of the trees. Her eyes closed slowly by themselves. Just rest for a moment now. Vengeance later.
Stupid old bastard,
she muttered. Her head dropped sideways. Brother! Pharaoh woke with a start, head knocking against the tree. It was light, too light. Another bright, hot day. How long had she been sleeping? Brother! A woman's voice, not far off. Where are you?
Over here.
Pharaoh froze, every muscle tensing. A man's voice, deep and strong, and close. She heard horses' hooves moving slowly, several horses, and near.
What are you doing, brother?
She's close, shouted the man again.
Pharaoh's throat tightened.
I can smell her.
Pharaoh felt in the bushes for her weapons, shoved the sword and the knife through her belt, tucked the other knife up her one torn sleeve.
I can taste her, sister. She's very close.
But where?
The woman's voice drew nearer.
Do you think she can hear us?
Perhaps she can, laughed the man. Are you there, Mal'jin?
She threw her quiver over her shoulder and snatched up her bow.
We are waiting,
he sang, getting closer still, just beyond the trees now.
Come out, Mal'jin. Come out and greet us.
She bolted away, crashing through the bushes, sprinting across the open ground with desperate speed.
There she is, cried the woman from behind. Look at her go.
Get her then, shouted the man.
The scrubby grassland stretched away unbroken before her. Nowhere to run to. She span around with a snarl, knocking an arrow to her bow. Four horsemen were spurring towards her, Girkish soldiers, sun glinting on their tall helmets and the cruel heads of their spears. Behind them, further back, were two other riders, a man and a woman.
Stop! In the name of the Emperor!
One of the horsemen shouted.
Fuck your Emperor!
Her arrow caught the first of the soldiers through his neck, and he tumbled backwards from the saddle with a shocked gurgle, his spear flying out of his hand.
Good shot, cried the woman.
The second rider took an arrow in his chest. His breastplate slowed it, but it still went deep enough to kill. He screamed, dropping his sword in the grass, clutching at the shaft, rolling in the saddle. The third never even made a sound. He got one in the mouth, at no more than 10 strides away. The point went right through his skull and knocked his helmet off, but by then the fourth was on her. She threw the bow to the ground and rolled away as the soldier thrust at her with his spear, then she pulled the sword from her belt, spitting on the grass.
Alive!
Shouted the woman, nudging her horse lazily forwards.
We need her alive!
The soldier turned his snorting mount and urged it cautiously towards Pharaoh. He was a big man, with a thick growth of dark stubble on his jaw.
I hope you've made your peace with God, girl, he said.
Fuck your God!
She scuttled out of the way, dodging, moving, staying close to the ground. The soldier jabbed at her with his spear, keeping her at a distance, his horse's hooves pawing at the ground, kicking dust in Pharaoh's face.
Poke her!
She heard the woman shouting behind her.
Yes, poke her!
Cried her brother through his giggling.
But not too hard! We want her alive!
The soldier snarled as he spurred his horse forward. Pharaoh ducked and scrambled in front of its kicking legs. The spear point jabbed, cutting a gash in her arm. She swung the sword with all her strength. The curved blade found the gap between the plates of the soldier's armor, took his leg off just below the knee, and opened a huge wound in the horse's side. Man and beast screamed together, fell together to the ground. Dark blood bubbled out across the dirt.
She got him!
The woman sounded mildly disappointed.
Up, man!
Laughed her brother.
Up and at her! There's still a chance!
The soldier thrashed on the ground. Pharaoh's sword hacked into his face, putting a sharp end to his screams. Nearby, the second rider was still in his saddle, face twisted, gasping his last breaths, hand clutched around the bloody shaft of her arrow. His horse put its head down and started nibbling at the dry grass by its hooves.
"That's all of them," said the woman.
"I know," her brother sighed deep. "Must one do everything oneself?" Pharaoh glanced up at them as she pushed the bloody sword back through her belt. They were sitting carelessly on their horses, not far off, the sun bright behind them, smiles on their cruel, handsome faces. They were dressed like lords, silk flapping round them in the breeze, heavy with jewellery, but neither one was armed. Pharaoh scrambled for her bow.
"Be careful, brother," said the woman, examining her fingernails. "She fights well."
"Like a devil. But she's no match for me, sister, have no fear." He sprang down from his saddle. "So then, Mal'jin, shall we?"
The arrow stuck him through the chest, deep through, with a hollow thud.
"Begin."
The shaft quivered, its point glittering behind him, dry and bloodless. He began to walk towards her. Her next arrow caught him through the shoulder, but he only came on faster, breaking into a run, bounding forward with enormous strides. She dropped the bow, fingers fumbling for the grip of her sword. Too slow. His outstretched arm caught her across the chest with terrible force, slamming her into the earth.
"Oh, well done, brother!"
The woman clapped her hands with delight.
"Well done!"
Pharaoh rolled, coughing in the dust. She saw the man watching her as she struggled to her feet, the sword clutched in both hands. She swung it at him, a great overhead arc. It bit deep into the earth. Somehow, he had already danced aside. A foot came out of nowhere and sank into her stomach. She doubled over, powerless, the air driven from her body. Her fingers twitched, the sword was left stuck in the ground, her knees wobbled.
"And now..."
Something crunched into her nose, her legs buckled, and the ground hit her hard in the back. She rolled groggily to her knees, the world turning over around her. There was blood on her face. She blinked and shook her head, trying to stop the world from spinning. The man was moving towards her, tipping, blurry. He jerked her arrow out of his chest and tossed it away. There was no blood, just a little dust. Just dust curling in the air. An eater. He had to be. Pharaoh stumbled up, pulling the knife from her belt. She thrust at him, missed, thrust again, missed again. Her head was swimming. She screamed, slashing at him with all her might. He caught her wrist in his hand. Their faces were less than a foot apart. His skin was perfect, smooth like dark glass. He looked young, almost like a child. But his eyes were old, hard eyes. He watched her, curious, amused, like a boy who found an interesting beetle.
"She doesn't give up, does she, sister?"
"Very fierce. The prophet will be delighted with her."
The man sniffed at Pharaoh and wrinkled his nose.
"Eh, she'd better be washed first."
She butted him in the face. His head snapped back, but he only giggled. He caught her round the throat with his free hand, shoved her out to arm's length. She clawed at his face, but his arm was too long, she couldn't reach. He was prizing her fingers from the handle of the knife. His grip was iron around her neck. She couldn't breathe. She bared her teeth, struggling, snarling, thrashing, all in vain.
"Alive, brother, we want her alive!"
"Alive," murmured the man, "but not unharmed."
The woman giggled. Pharaoh's feet left the ground, kicking at the air. She felt one of her fingers snap, and the knife dropped to the grass. The hand gripped tight around her neck, and she tore at it with broken nails. All in vain. The bright world began to turn dark. Pharaoh heard the woman laughing, far away. A face swam out of the darkness. A hand stroked Pharaoh's cheek. The fingers were soft, warm, gentle.
"Be still, child,"
whispered the woman. Her eyes were dark and deep. Pharaoh could feel her breath, hot and fragrant on her face.
You are hurt. You must rest. Be still now. Sleep.
Pharaoh's legs were heavy as lead. She kicked weakly one last time, then her body sagged. Her heart beat slow.
Rest now.
Pharaoh's eyelids began to droop. The woman's beautiful face grew blurred.
Sleep.
Pharaoh bit down hard on her tongue, and her mouth turned salty.
Be still.
Pharaoh spat blood in the woman's face.
Gah!
She shouted in disgust, wiping blood from her eyes.
She fights me.
Her kind fight everything, came the man's voice just behind Pharaoh's ear.
Now listen to me, whore,
hissed the woman, clutching Pharaoh's jaw with steely fingers and yanking her face this way and that.
You are coming with us. With us. One way or another. You hear me?
She goes nowhere.
Another voice, deep and mellow. It seemed familiar. Pharaoh blinked, shook her head groggily. The woman had turned, looking at an old man not far away.
Yulwe.
His bangles jingled as he padded softly across the grass.
Are you alive, Pharaoh?
Ah!
She croaked. The woman sneered at Yulwe.
Who are you, old bastard?
Yulwe sighed.
I am an old bastard. Get you gone, dog, shouted the man. We come from the Prophet, from Kalul himself.
And she comes with us.
Yulwe looked sad.
I cannot change your minds.
They laughed together.
Fool, cried the man. Our minds never change.
He let go of one of Pharaoh's arms, took a wary step forwards, dragging her with him.
A shame, said Yulwe, shaking his head. I would have had you carry my respects to Kalul.
The Prophet does not walk with the likes of you, beggar.
I might surprise you. We knew each other well long ago.
I will give our master your respects then, jeered the woman, with the news of your recent death.
Pharaoh twisted her wrist, felt the knife drop into her palm.
Oh, Kalul would enjoy that news, but he will not receive it yet. The two of you have cursed yourselves. You have broken the second law. You have eaten the flesh of men, and there must be a reckoning.
Old fool, sneered the woman. Your laws do not apply to us.
Yulwe slowly shook his head.
The word of Eos governs all. There can be no exceptions. Neither one of you will leave this place alive.
The air around the old man shimmered, twisted, blurred. The woman gave a gurgle and dropped suddenly to the earth, more than falling, melting, flopping, dark silk flapping around her collapsing body.
Sister!
The man let go of Pharaoh, sprang at Yulwe, arms outstretched. He got no further than a stride. He gave a sudden shrill scream and dropped to his knees, clutching at his head. Pharaoh forced her stumbling feet forward, grabbed hold of his hair with her broken hand, and drove the knife into his neck. Dust blew out into the wind, a fountain of dust. Flames flickered around his mouth, charring his lips black, licking burning hot at her fingers. She dropped on top of him, bearing him back onto the ground, choking, snorting. The blade opened up his stomach, scraped against his ribs, snapped off in his chest. Fire licked out, fire and dust. She hacked at the body mindlessly with the broken knife long after it had stopped moving. She felt a hand on her shoulder.
He is dead, Pharaoh. They both are dead.
She saw it was true. The man lay on his back, staring up at the sky, face charred round his nose and mouth, dust blowing from the gaping wounds.
I killed him.
Her voice cracked and broken in her throat.
No, Pharaoh. I did that. They were young eaters, weak and foolish. Still, you are lucky they wanted only to catch you.
I am lucky,
she mumbled, dribbling bloody spit onto the eater's corpse.
She dropped the broken knife, crawled away on all fours. The body of the woman lay next to her, if you could call it that, a shapeless, lumpy mass of flesh. She saw long hair and an eye and lips.
"What did you do?"
she croaked through her bloody mouth.
"I turned her bones to water and burned him from the inside. Water for one, fire for the other. Whatever works for their kind."
Pharaoh rolled over on the grass, looking up at the bright sky. She held her hand in front of her face, shook it. One of her fingers flopped back and forth. Yulwe's face appeared above, staring down at her.
"Does it hurt?"
"No,"
she whispered, letting her arm drop back to the earth.
"It never does."
She blinked up at Yulwe.
"Why does it never hurt?"
The old man frowned.
"They will not stop seeking for you, Pharaoh. Do you see now why you have to come with me?"
She nodded slowly. The effort was immense.
"I see,"
she whispered.
"I see."
The world grew dark again. Chapter 34. She loves me, not.
"Ah!"
cried Giselle, as the point of Filio's steel dug hard into his shoulder. He stumbled back, wincing and cursing, and the Styrian smiled at him and flourished his steels.
"A touch to Master Filio!"
bellowed the referee.
"That's two each!"
There was some scattered clapping as Filio strutted back to the contestants' enclosure with an irritating smile across his face.
"Slippery bastard,"
Giselle hissed to himself as he followed. He should have seen that lunge coming. He had been careless, and he knew it.
"Two apiece?"
hissed Varouz as Giselle flopped down into his chair, breathing hard.
"Two apiece? Against this nobody? He's not even from the Union!"
Giselle knew better than to point out that Westport was supposed to be a part of the Union these days. He knew what Varouz meant, and so did everyone else in the arena. The man was an outsider, as far as they were concerned. He grabbed the cloth from West's outstretched hands and wiped his sweaty face. Five touches was a long match, but Filio looked far from exhausted. He was springing up and down on his toes as Giselle glanced across, nodding his head to the noisy Styrian advice spilling from his trainer.
"You can beat him,"
West murmured as he handed Giselle the water bottle.
"You can beat him, and then it's the final."
The final. That meant Gorst. Giselle wasn't entirely sure he wanted any of that. But Varouz was in no doubt.
"Just damn well beat him,"
hissed the marshal, as Giselle took a swig from the bottle, swilled it round in his mouth.
"Just beat him!"
Giselle spat half out into the bucket and swallowed the rest. Just beat him. Easy to say, but he was a devious bastard, this Styrian.
"You can do it,"
said West again, rubbing Giselle's shoulder.
"You've come this far. Kill him! Just kill him!"
Marshal Varouz stared into Giselle's eyes.
"Are you a nobody, Captain Luther? Did I waste my time on you? Or are you somebody, eh? Now's the time to decide."
"Gentlemen, please," called the referee. "The deciding touch."
Giselle blew out hard, took his steels from West, got to his feet. He could hear Filio's trainer shouting encouragements over the swelling noise of the crowd.
"Just kill him,"
shouted Varouz one last time, then Giselle was off on his way to the circle. The deciding touch. The decider, in so many ways. Whether Giselle would be in the final or not. Whether he would be somebody or not. He was tired, though, very tired. He had been fencing solidly for nearly half an hour in the heat, and that takes it out of you. He was sweating again already. He could feel it leaking out of his face in big drops. He moved towards his mark, a bit of chalk on some dry grass. Filio was standing there waiting, still smiling, anticipating his triumph. The little shit. If Gorst could club those others around the circle, then surely Giselle could grind this fool's face in the turf. He squeezed the grips of his steels and concentrated on that nauseating little smile. He wished for a moment that the steels weren't blunted, until it occurred to him that he might be the one who got stabbed.
Begin!
Giselle sorted through his cards, shuffling them this way and that in his hands, barely even looking at the symbols on them, barely caring whether he kept them out of sight of the others.
"I'll raise you 10, said Casper, sliding some coins across the table with a look that said,
oh, something, probably. Giselle didn't care what, he really wasn't concentrating. There was a lengthy pause.
"It's your bet, Giselle," grumbled Jallanhorm. "It is? Oh,
he scanned across the meaningless symbols, unable to take any of it too seriously.
I'll fold."
He tossed the cards onto the table. He was down today, well down, for the first time in he couldn't remember how long. Ever, probably. He was too busy thinking about Ardy, wondering how he could bed her without doing either one of them lasting harm, most particularly without his being killed by West. He was still no closer to an answer, unfortunately. Casper swept up the coins, smiling broadly at his most unlikely victory.
"So that was well fought today, Giselle. A close one, but you came through, eh?"
"Ah," said Giselle. He took his pipe from the table.
"I swear, I thought he had you for a minute there, but then,"
and he snapped his fingers under Brint's nose,
"just like that, knocked him right over. The crowd loved it. I laughed so hard, I nearly wet myself, I swear."
"You reckon you can beat Gorst?" asked Jallanhorm.
"Eh."
Giselle shrugged, lighting the pipe and leaning back in his chair, looking up at the grey sky and sucking on the stem.
"You seem pretty calm about it all," said Brint.
The three officers glanced at each other, disappointed by the failure of their chosen topic. Casper picked another.
"Have you fellows seen the Princess Therese yet?"
Brint and Jallanhorm sighed and gasped, then the three of them prattled their gormless appreciation of the woman.
"Have I seen her? Have I ever?
They call her the Jewel of Talons.
The rumours didn't lie where she's concerned.
I hear the marriage to Prince Ladislaw is a fixed thing.
The lucky bastard,"
and so on. Giselle stayed where he was, sat back in his chair, blowing smoke at the sky. He wasn't so sure about Therese from the little he'd seen. Beautiful from a distance, no doubt, but he imagined that her face would feel like glass to the touch. Cold, hard and brittle. Nothing like Ardy's.
"Still," Jallanhorm was spouting, "I have to say, Casper, my heart still belongs to your cousin, Aris. Give me a union girl any day over one of these foreigners."
"Give you her money, you mean?" murmured Giselle, head still tipped back.
"No," complained the big man. "She's a perfect lady. Sweet, demure, well-bred. Ah!"
Giselle smiled to himself. If Therese was cold glass, then Aris was a dead fish. Kissing her would be like kissing an old rag, he imagined, limp and tedious. She couldn't kiss the way Ardy did. No one could.
"Well, they're both of them beauties, no doubt," Brint was blathering. "Fine women to dream about, if dreams are all you're after."
He leaned forward to a conspiratorial distance, smirking shiftily round as though he had something secret and exciting to say. The other two edged their chairs forward, but Giselle stayed where he was. He had no interest at all in hearing about whatever whore that idiot was bedding.
"Have you met West's sister?" murmured Brint.
Giselle's every muscle stiffened.
"She's not the equal of those two, of course, but she's really quite pretty, in a common sort of way, and I think she'd be willing."
Brint licked his lips and nudged Jallanhorm in the ribs. The big man grinned guiltily like a schoolboy at a dirty joke.
"Oh, yes, she strikes me as the willing type,"
Caspar giggled. Giselle put his pipe down on the table, noticing that his hand was trembling slightly. The other was gripping the arm of his chair so hard that his knuckles were white.
"I do declare," said Brint. "If I didn't think the Major would stick me with his sword, I'd be tempted to stick his sister with mine, eh?"
Jallanhorm spluttered with laughter. Giselle felt one of his eyes twitching as Brint turned his smirk towards him.
"Well, Giselle, what do you think? You've met her, haven't you?"
"What do I think?"
His voice seemed to come from a terribly long way away as he stared at those three grinning faces.
"I think you should watch your mouth, you son of a fucking whore."
He was on his feet now, teeth gritted so tight together they felt like they might crack apart. The three smiles blinked and faded. Giselle felt Caspar's hand on his arm.
"Come on, he only meant..."
Giselle ripped his arm away, seized the edge of the table, and flung it over. Coins, cards, bottles, glasses flew through the air and spilled out across the grass. He had his sword in his other hand, still sheathed, luckily, leaning right down over Brint, spraying spit in his face.
"Now you fucking listen to me, you little bastard," he snarled. "I hear anything more like that, anything, and you won't have to worry about West."
He pressed the grip of his steel into Brint's chest.
"I'll carve you like a fucking chicken."
The three men stared up at him, aghast, their mouths wide open, their astonishment at this sudden display of violence equaled only by Giselle's own.
"But," said Jallanhorm.
"What?"
screamed Giselle, seizing a fistful of the big man's jacket and dragging him half out of his chair.
"What do you fucking say?"
"Nothing,"
he squeaked, his hands raised.
"Nothing."
Giselle let him drop. The fury was draining fast. He had half a mind to apologize, but when he saw Brint's ashen face, all he could think of was, "She strikes me as the willing type."
"Like a fucking chicken,"
he snarled again, then turned on his heel and stalked off. Halfway to the archway, he realized he had left his coat behind, but he could hardly go back for it now. He made it into the darkness of the tunnel, took a couple of steps down it, then sagged against the wall, breathing hard and trembling as if he'd just run 10 miles. He understood now what it meant to lose one's temper, and no mistake. He had never even realized that he had one before, but there could be no doubt now.
"What the hell was that about?"
Brint's shocked voice echoed quietly down the tunnel, only just audible over the thumping of Giselle's heart. He had to hold his breath to hear.
"Damned if I know,"
Jallanhorm, sounding even more surprised. There was the rattle and scrape of the table being put straight.
"Never knew he had such a temper."
"I suppose he must have a lot to think about," said Caspar uncertainly.
"What with the contest and all?"
Brint cut him off.
"That's no excuse."
"Well, they're close, aren't they? Him and West. What with all the fencing together and what have you, maybe he knows the sister or something. I don't know."
"There is another explanation,"
Giselle could hear Brint saying, voice tense as though he was about to deliver a punchline.
"Perhaps he's in love with her."
The three of them burst out laughing. It was a good joke, all right. Captain Giselle Dan Luthar in love, and with a girl whose station in life was so far beneath his own. What a ridiculous idea! What an absurd notion! What a joke!
"Oh, shit."
Giselle put his head in his hands. He didn't feel like laughing. How the hell had she done this to him? How? What was it about her? She was fine to look at, of course, and clever, and funny, and all those things, but that was no explanation.
"I cannot see her again,"
he whispered to himself.
"I will not."
And he thumped his hand against the wall. His resolve was iron. It always was. Until the next note came under his door. He groaned and slapped the side of his head.
Why did he feel like this? Why did he... He couldn't even bring himself to think the word, like her so much. Then it came to him. He knew why. She didn't like him. Those mocking half-smiles, those sidelong glances he caught sometimes, those jokes that went just a little too close to the bone, not to mention the occasional examples of outright scorn. She liked his money, maybe. She liked his position in the world, of course. She liked his looks, undoubtedly. But in essence, the woman despised him. And he'd never had that feeling before. He'd always just assumed that everybody loved him, had never really had cause to doubt he was a fine man, worthy of the highest respect. But Adi didn't like him. He saw it now, and that made him think. Apart from the jaw, of course, and the money and the clothes, what was there to like? She treated him with the contempt he knew he deserved, and he couldn't get enough of it. "Strangest thing," Giselle mumbled to himself, slouching miserably against the wall of the tunnel. "Strangest thing." It made him want to change her mind. Chapter 35 The Seed.
How are you, Sand?
Colonel Glockter opened his eyes. It was dark in the room.
Damn it, he was late. Damn it,
he shouted, shoving back the covers and leaping out of bed. I'm late! He snatched up his uniform trousers, shoving his legs in, fumbling with his belt.
Don't worry about that, Sand.
His mother's voice was half-soothing, half-impatient.
Where is the seed?
Glockter frowned over as he pushed his shirt in.
I've no time for this nonsense, Mother. Why do you always think you know what's best for me?
He cast around him for his sword, but couldn't see it.
We're at war, you know.
We are indeed.
The colonel looked up, surprised. It was the voice of Archlector Salt.
Two wars. One fought with fire and steel, another one beneath, an old war, long years in the making.
Glockter frowned. However could he have mistaken that old windbag for his mother? And what was he doing in Glockter's chamber in any case? Sitting in the chair at the foot of his bed, prattling about old wars?
What the hell are you doing in my chambers? Growled Colonel Glockter. And what have you done with my sword?
Where is the seed? A woman's voice now, but not his mother's, someone else. He did not recognize it. He squinted against the darkness, straining to see who was in the chair. He could make out a vague outline, but the shadows were too deep to tell more.
Who are you?
Asked Glockter sternly.
Who was I? Or what am I?
The figure in the chair shifted as it rose slowly, smoothly from its seat.
I was a patient woman, but I am woman no more, and the grinding years have worn my patience thin. What do you want?
Glockter's voice quivered, reedy and weak as he backed away. The figure moved, stepping through the shaft of moonlight from the window. A woman's form, slender and graceful, but shadows stuck to the face. A sudden fear clawed at him, and he stumbled back against the wall, raising his arm to fend the woman off.
I want the seed.
A pale hand snaked out and closed around his outstretched arm. A gentle touch, but cold, cold as stone. Glockter trembled, gasped, squeezed shut his eyes.
I need it. You cannot know the need I have. Where is it?
Fingers plucked at his clothes, quick and deft, seeking, searching, darting in his pockets, in his shirt, brushing his skin. Cold, cold as glass.
The seed?
Squeaked Glockter, half paralyzed with terror.
You know what I speak of, broken man. Where is it?
The Maker fell,
he whispered. The words welled up, he knew not from where.
I know it.
Burning, burning,
I saw it. The face was close enough for him to feel the breath upon his skin. Cold, cold as frost.
He broke upon the bridge below.
I remember it.
They searched for the seed.
Yes, whispered the voice, urgent in his ear. Where is it?
Something brushed against his face, his cheek, his eyelids, soft and slimy.
A tongue. Cold, cold as ice.
His flesh crawled.
I don't know. They could not find it.
Could not.
Fingers closed tight around his throat, squeezing, crushing, choking the air from him.
Cold, cold as iron, and just as hard. You think you know pain, broken man? You know nothing.
The icy breath rasped in his ear. The icy fingers squeezed, squeezed.
But I can show you. I can show you.
Glockter screamed, thrashed, struggled. He fought his way up, stood for a dizzy instant, then his leg buckled and he plunged into space. The dark room tumbled around him, and he crashed to the boards with a sickening crunch, his arm folded beneath him, his forehead cracking against the floor. He struggled up, clawing at the leg of his bed, pushing himself against the wall, snorting for breath, staring wild-eyed towards the chair, yet barely able to look for fear. A bar of moonlight spilled through the window, cut across the rumpled bedclothes and onto the polished wood of the seat.
Empty.
Glockter cast around the rest of the room, eyes adjusting to the darkness, peering into every shadowy corner.
Nothing. Empty. A dream.
And now, as the crazy hammering of his heart relaxed, as his ragged breathing slowed, the pain came on. His head thumped, his leg screamed, his arm was throbbing dully. He could taste blood. His eyes stung and wept, his guts heaved, sick and spinning. He whimpered, made an agonizing hop towards the bed, then collapsed on the moonlit mattress, exhausted, wet with cold sweat. There was an urgent knocking at the door.
"Sir, are you all right?"
Barnum's voice. The knocking came again.
"No good. It is locked. Always locked. But I don't think I'll be moving. Frost will have to break it down."
But the door swung open, and Glockter shielded his eyes from the sudden ruddy glow of the old servant's lamp.
"Are you all right?"
"I fell," mumbled Glockter. "My arm."
The old servant perched on the bed, taking Glockter's hand gently and pushing up the sleeve of his nightshirt. Glockter winced. Barnum clicked his tongue. His forearm had a big pink mark across it, already beginning to swell and redden.
"I don't think it's broken," said the servant, "but I should fetch the surgeon just in case."
"Yes, yes."
He waved Barnum away with his good hand.
"Fetch him."
Glockter watched the old servant hurry, stooped out of the door, heard him creaking along the narrow corridor outside, down the narrow stairs. He heard the front door banging shut. Silence descended. He looked over at the scroll he had taken from the Adeptus Historical, still rolled up tight on the dresser, waiting to be delivered to Arch-Lector Salt.
"The Maker fell burning. He broke upon the bridge below. Strange how parts of the waking world stray into one's dreams. That damned Northman and his intruder. A woman, and cold. That'll be what set me off."
Glockter rubbed his arm gently, pressing the sore flesh with his fingertips.
"Nothing. Just a dream."
And yet something was niggling at him. He looked over at the back of the door. The key was still in the lock, shining orange in the light from the lamp.
"Not locked. And yet I must have locked it. Must have. I always do."
Glockter looked back to the empty chair.
"What did that idiot apprentice say? Magic comes from the other side, the world below. Hell.
Somehow, at that moment, after that dream, it did not seem so difficult to believe. The fear was building in him again, now he was alone. He stretched out his good hand towards the chair. It took an age to get there, trembling, shaking. His fingers touched the wood. Cool, but not cold. Not cold. There is nothing there. He slowly withdrew his hand, cradling his pulsing arm. Nothing. Empty. A dream.
What the hell happened to you? Glockter sucked sourly at his gums.
Fell out of bed.
He scratched absently at his wrist through the dressing. Until a moment ago it had been throbbing like hell, but the sight in front of him had pushed the pain into the back of his mind.
I could be worse off, a lot worse. Not a pretty sight, not at all.
You're damn right it's not.
Severard looked as disgusted as was possible with half his face covered. I nearly puked when I first saw it, me. Glockter peered down, frowning, at the tangled mess of butchery, supporting himself against a tree trunk with one hand and pushing some of the ferns aside with the tip of his cane to get a better look.
Are we even sure it's a man?
Might be a woman. Human, anyway. That's a foot.
Ah, so it is. How was it found?
He found it.
Severard nodded over towards a gardener, sat on the ground, pale-faced and staring, and with a small pool of drying vomit on the grass beside him.
In amongst the trees here, hidden in the bushes. Looks as if whatever killed it tried to hide it, but not long ago it's fresh.
It is indeed. Barely any smell, and only a couple of flies have arrived. Very fresh. Perhaps last night, even.
It might not have been found for days, except someone asked for one of these trees to be pruned, blocking out the light or something. You ever seen anything like this?
Glockter shrugged.
In Angland once, before you came.
One of the convicts tried to escape. He made it a few miles, then succumbed to the cold. A bear made free with the corpse. That was quite a mess, though not near as bad as this one.
I can't see anyone freezing to death last night. It was hot as hell.
Said Glockter. If hell is hot, I've always thought it might be cold. Cold as ice.
There are few bears within the Agriont in any case. Do we have any idea as to the identity of this?
He waved his cane towards the carcass.
Person?
None.
Is anyone unaccounted for, reported missing?
Not that I've heard.
So we have not the slightest idea even who our victim is. Why the hell are we taking an interest? Don't we have a fake Magus to be watching?
That's just it. Their new quarters are right over there.
Severard's gloved finger pointed out a building not 20 strides away.
I was watching them when this came to light.
Glockter raised an eyebrow.
I see. And you suspect some connection, do you?
The practical shrugged.
Mysterious intruders in the dead of night, gruesome murders on their very doorstep. Our visitors draw trouble like shit draws flies.
Ah, said Severard, swatting a fly away with his gloved hand. I looked into that other thing as well. Your bankers, Valent and Bulk.
Glockter looked up.
Really? And?
And not a lot. An old house, very old and very well respected. Their notes are good as gold among the merchants. They've got offices all across Middleland, Angland, Starrickland, in Westport, in Dagoska, even outside the Union. Powerful people, by all accounts. All kinds of folk owe them money, I reckon. Strange thing, though, no one seems ever to have met a Valent or a Bulk. Who can tell with banks, though, eh? They love secrets. You want me to dig any more?
It could be dangerous. Very dangerous. Dig too far, and we might be digging our own graves. No. We'd better leave off, for now.
Keep your ears open, though. My ears are always open, Chief.
So, who'd you like for the contest?
Glockter glanced across at the practical.
How can you think about that with this in front of you?
The practical shrugged.